Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to introduce John Friend. He is the founder of Anusara Yoga, and he will be in Santa Fe this Friday, October 5th at 7 o'clock at the Immaculate Heart of Mary at 50 Mount Carmel Road, right here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. You founded Anusara Yoga about 10 years ago. How do you just go about founding a new yoga practice?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, backing up a little bit, it's very unorthodox because yoga's tradition goes back thousands of years. And in the Hatha Yoga world, Hatha Yoga is several hundred years old. And typically, a student would follow a teacher and just stay with that one teacher and that one style forever. And then that student, becoming a teacher, then would pass it on to another student, and the lineage is just maintained through generations. So it's very unusual to completely branch away. The difference is that these days in the 21st century, we have such a different culture and different time that we can often become very innovative. And when the innovation differs so much from the previous path, it's time to take a different name. And for me, I took a different name because what I was practicing and what I was doing would not be necessarily accepted or well received by my teacher, who I so respect and so honor. So, you know, when there's a difference, when it comes down to philosophy or technique, then it's time really to set your own mark. And these days, people change and innovate so readily that there are many different styles of yoga now, many different styles of Hatha Yoga. And Anusara Yoga is just one of those styles of Hatha Yoga.
Well, what are the traditions, the yoga traditions on which Anusara Yoga is based, and how is it similar to and different from those traditions that you broke off from?
The Anusara Yoga being, it's Hatha Yoga, and the main styles that have influenced me have been Iyengar Yoga and Shivananda Yoga. There are many different styles of Hatha Yoga that I've been exposed to and have practiced through the years. And philosophically, Anusara is very much aligned with tantric philosophy. So in yoga, there are at least three main types of philosophical schools. There are the tantric school, the Vedantic school, and the classical school. So what I had practiced before in my Hatha Yoga studies were mainly Vedantic and classical. And about almost 20 years ago, I started to practice more tantric philosophy. So that was very influential for me and really compelled me to move into my own thing.
Well, what are the principles of tantric philosophy?
The principles of tantric philosophy and really what they the tenets that really differ from classical or from Vedanta include that we see the world and we see ourselves as embodiments of one supreme consciousness. And in classical yoga, for instance, the world and ourselves are seen as a collection of duality, of spirit and matter. So there's spirit or consciousness, but it's embodied within a material vessel, if you will. which is the physical body and the emotions and the mind. So in classical yoga, you're doing yoga in a way that will help to create some separation and a disidentification between spirit and matter. And in Tantra, we see that we are, it's all spirit at different levels of frequency and different levels of manifestation. So it's not a dualistic system and not a dualistic vision. So Tantra sees essentially everything as divine. At least its essence is divine. And inherent in that is freedom, a great amount of freedom. Now, when we're embodied, there is that freedom, but it's in a limited form. So we have free will, but at the same time, we don't see clearly that we all are interconnected and intertwined. So we often make choices and decisions that are not necessarily life-enhancing for ourselves or our environment or others. And so suffering will ensue because of that lack of clear insight and clear understanding. So Tantra practices a vision that helps one to reveal the true insight that we are all interconnected, and to really enjoy this day and this night as a glorification of this one spirit in all of its diverse manifestations.
We're talking to John Friend, founder of Anusara Yoga. I suppose the concept of spirit being embodied in matter comes very much from the phenomena of life and death. In other words, when somebody dies, the body is dead, the matter is still there, but their spirit is gone. They're no longer, as they say, animating that body. How is spirit there in a person or a creature who's no longer alive?
Yeah, all right, good question. Again, we realize that we all know that when a body dies, even the body that we think of is inanimate and as lifeless, it still has some sort of aliveness in that there are enzymes and chemicals that are still functioning and decomposing the body. So, the body returns back to the elements of the earth, so to speak. And the spirit, what we might consider one's soul, if you will, or the, which is like the self-identification of the being, that, has broken its connection to the body for the most part and is free of that embodiment. So, we still see in the tantric vision, we still see that even that which seems to be inanimate is actually still full of energy and still full of consciousness. Even, we even consider rocks and, that which is apparently lifeless to be still full of vibrating energy.
And so how does that translate into a practice of yoga, which is about doing postures and movements?
So in the practice of Hatha Yoga, that is about these physical poses and breathing exercises and includes meditation and really doing anything in your body, it's about aligning the body and aligning the mind in ways that this internal energy, the life force within the body and within the mind, can be so optimally flowing that a revelation of insight, a revelation of awakening can occur, and an optimal flow of health and well-being that you really feel, you feel better. You feel there's a natural revelation of happiness, and even in the highest, there's forms of what we might think of as bliss or ecstasy within the body. So we see the body as such a beautiful gift of life that through this body we get to enjoy every day and every night through our senses and through the sharing of all of the experience with others, the environment, animals, etc. So So it's really a joyful manifestation, and the yoga poses are not only gateways to have that kind of insight and experience of ecstasy, but the poses themselves can be expressions of this joy, and they can be really more seen as forms of art, spiritual art. So we're doing the poses as expressions of a spirit in order to make beauty and to glorify the spirit. And so when even others might see the asanas or the poses practiced by a tantrika or practiced by like an Anusara yoga person, then hopefully the observer will be so inspired and so uplifted by the beauty that they themselves can have a revelation of their own state of delight and their own state of divinity.
You use the word art, and it's very interesting. For somebody who has been doing yoga for a while, there's a tremendous beauty in what they're doing. For people who are beginners, it's, I suppose, like any beginner thing, you're sort of bumbling and stumbling around. Is that joy, is that art, is that spirit that you're talking about accessible to beginners, or is it something you really have to practice for a very long time?
Yeah. All right. Again, really, really good question. The amazing thing is that many times in the state of a beginner, there is so much openness of mind and awareness, and so much openness of just their heart, their spirit, that they don't already have any preconceptions. And many times, by that kind of openness, they find themselves, they're able to even be guided more into alignment more easily than somebody who often has so much experience that the mind is actually blocking them with preconceptions and so on. So many times a beginner in their very first class of yoga can have an amazing experience of revelation, that they just feel so good in their body, and they gain like flashes of insight into their own nature and to the nature of things. So one can get it in their very first class. They can get an experience of it, at least a taste of it. And then, you know, if they apply the practices and can maintain that kind of beginner mind, the state of awareness and the state of openness will only develop. And, of course, let's say that as an art, you know, like a neophyte in any art, they might have a good intention, but they don't have the technical knowledge and really the cultivated skill to make the art really beautiful. You know, they might have a purity in the beginning, but they're still really rough. I mean, you could easily determine a beginning artist from an accomplished master because you can look at the technique, you can look at the development. So similarly in yoga, you can see that you might have a beginner who might be able to have an amazing experience on their first day, but still, their art, their expression of the yoga is very raw, and they have to be guided and they have to be taught the technical knowledge that can be applied and many different insights into how to integrate the philosophy actually into the embodiment of the practice.
We're talking to John Friend, founder of Anusara Yoga. You are going to be here in Santa Fe giving a talk called Transforming the Profane into the Sacred. Those are terms that people use, but I wonder what they mean. What do the terms profane and sacred mean?
All right, well, the profane, I'm defining it as something where there's a place or an energy has become somewhat disconnected from the very essence of life, to the degree that its energy is heavy and dull, and where there creates even further disconnect and further blockage of perception. Where, for instance, you walk into a place that where a tragedy has occurred. Maybe even a place where a real horrible incident, like even a murder, has occurred. And the energy in that place will be very different than a place that has been sanctified and purified for more of a spiritual awakening, like in a temple or a church. or something, an area that we would consider sacred, where the vibration of that place is vibrating so high that when you do come into it, you are also uplifted to the point where your awareness is also expanded. So the profane place is one where instead of an expansion of consciousness, profane energy actually creates more of a cloaking. And it can be considered a very mundane, low-level energy. It can be a place where, like if you go into a place where, like in an inner slum, where drug addicts might be hanging out in a room, and the energy of the place is very darkened. There's it's not just by the physical light, but a dark energy where it's even further blocking their awareness. And those that come into that space are also affected in a similar fashion. So the profane and the sacred are terms that are generally describing a spectrum of energy, a spectrum of consciousness that can be vibrating in any place at any time.
Now, all of them are, as you say, manifestations of this great non-dual divine reality.
Right.
And so how do you transform one into the other?
Yeah, great. So it all is like in a rainbow, you have one light that at different frequencies we call them different colors. And this, the matter of the transformation, the alchemy of changing one vibratory state to another is like changing like a crimson color into a violet. And there is specific technique on how to do this, that you can literally take a place that is very, very profane, where tragedy and horrible incidences have occurred, and that those incidences have left their energetic mark. And there are ways of recalibrating the energy in these places so that they literally become sparkling. They become so high vibratory essence that just getting into the space that the observer will literally be uplifted and expanded. And the techniques, there's many different techniques, like on the talk that I'll give on Friday, and I'll give many examples, and I'll also give step-by-step processes. And they can include as simple as, just even like cleaning your house. I mean, it can be as simple as just preparing a place to become more sanctified, literally by just cleaning. Like if you've gone into a room that has been not really well attended to say the least, and it's cluttered and dirty and it's just, you know, there's junk all over, you feel the energy in these places can be down or a little dull and damp and dark. And then just cleaning the place up and organizing it, it's like not only does it just look better on the outside, but energetically you literally feel that there's more of a sparkly tendency to the room. So as simple as just cleaning is one thing. I mean, that's very kind of a mundane way of changing the vibratory state. But there are many other ways that it can include how you place things within a room, the furniture, how you organize a room, that how your intentionality affects the room, and how you, when you're setting even the room, everything using elements of like cleaning with water or sanctifying with water or sanctifying with fire, like flame, or using sound, using incense. There are many different ways of doing it. And through the years, when I've been to different places around the world, and I've gone purposely to places that have been considered really negative places where horrible incidences have taken place. Recently, I was in Germany, for instance, in East Berlin, and it's where the Nazis had murdered Jews openly in public and had taken books out of the library and had burnings. And you could literally feel the energy at these special places.
Even all these years later?
Yeah, and even 60 years later, you could feel, like, and you almost can see it. It's like if you even take a person, just doesn't even even consider this type of thing or believe in it, but you have them just stand there and look in a way, and they start to see, yeah, there's a dullness. There's like, it's like the even the atmosphere, even outside where these books were burned and where people were murdered, it's like the air is dirty, even on a day where it's sunny. And we would do, myself and my students would do some ceremony that would be very, very universal type of ceremony that you're not connected to, you know, any religion, but just practices of spirit that would help to totally transform these places. And you would literally within 30 minutes or an hour, you'd start to see the place literally scintillating with a light, with a new vibration. And to be there was more uplifting. And we would get on our bicycles as a group and even ride through the town, and it was as if we were just moving down through city streets in ways that were cleansing the atmosphere. It was very beautiful.
Have you ever been to a more current sort of present-day war zone?
I've not gone to any current places like Iraq or in Africa. I've been to Ground Zero in the United States, you know, at the Twin Towers in New York. And there's definitely an energetic thing there. So, you know, that was, and there was so much energy from so many people, even people that don't visit that area, just to see the image, I think, sends energy to that place, and both negative and positive. And I think there's been so many blessings that have been offered to that place that the vibration of the place is really coming up. And all around Ground Zero in New York City, for instance, there's a lot of really positive construction. There's a lot of positive growth and expansion. And the people that are living in the neighborhood, I'd say in general, there's a very really positive, optimistic, really almost even entrepreneurial sense. So, you know, I think that we've taken that place and in just a matter of a few years have made incredible shifts.
You're the founder of Anusara Yoga. What does the term Anusara mean?
Anusara means, literally it means flowing with grace, to follow your heart. And the idea is that if we line up with nature's flow, if we attune to the rhythms within ourselves and all around us, the very highest rhythms of nature and spirit itself, that an awakening, even just insights into the beauty of ourselves, to the goodness of ourselves, happen. That the more that we line up with nature in optimal ways, that our essence of joy and our essence of beauty arise and are able to be more expressed and manifested in our world. So Anusara means to flow with spirit.
Now, you talk about flow and you talk about rhythm. On Friday, when you're in Santa Fe, a classical Indian musician, Jyoti Chalam, will be there with you. What's the role of music in the form of yoga that you teach?
Music is very important to me. I think everybody would agree that music in general is very evocative. And a variety of musics, you know, music, we, you know, you'd ask anybody and they have their preferences in general. You know, some people like some music, some don't like music, and or some types of music. And the music that I often have in my workshops and like here, Jyoti will be singing, it's so uplifting. And because I'm giving a talk on changing the profane to the sacred, her offering will be so important because her chanting is so full of devotion and it's so beautiful, her sound, that it will just completely transform the space even before I speak. So she'll give a little singing before I offer my presentation, and she'll even perhaps even get a little song afterward. And her songs come right from the heart, and she'll be just offering her own prayers, her own blessings to everyone and to the space itself. So it'll be preparing for even the days to come where I'll be teaching in that same room for the following 5 days after the Friday night talk.
There's something I want to ask you. So there are different people, different groups have a tremendous love for some particular genre of music. Some people really love heavy metal. Some people love Indian classical music. Some people love, as I do, Afro-Cuban music. Are they all equal in terms of, I mean, if you love them, is the, shall we say, purification of the space in which they take place the same?
Yeah. Well, I really like your questions. No. The way it works is that, you know, it's interesting. We can have, like, if, let's say that you're a little bit out of balance or you're a little bit out of sync with things. And interestingly, many times we'll choose rhythms and music that are actually taking us further out of balance. And some music, just by its rhythms and its sounds, can actually create less life-enhancing attributes, whereas some music can be very uplifting and expansive, and this is just in general. Now, the thing is you can take, even let's say you take some music that is not so generally life-enhancing, that I really believe that you can still take that music and listening to it, you can still transform it in ways that still help you and help one. And it's a matter of really setting your intention and setting your attitude in ways that are very life-enhancing and very positive and very expansive in the heart, that you use the rhythms like, you know, like in Cuban music or Latin music, that it can really unlock some creative energy in you that can be used for the upliftment of yourself and others. So in that way, the music, I think, can be used in very positive ways. And there are actually some scientific studies where they would play different types of music for the same group of plants and flowers, and they would see tremendous and significant different growth patterns based on the different types of music that the plants and the flowers were exposed to.
I guess the thing so that's so striking
is
that
some music was actually deleterious or harmful to the plants, while some music was actually uplifting and beneficial.
But, I mean, for humans, for people, so my deleterious music is your uplifting music, and I find that so amazing.
Yeah, it's, again, it's like you have these basic premises that there are certain vibratory levels that where cellular activity, for instance, will not be enhanced, while some vibration will actually make the cells be really radiant and very healthy. And at the same time, it'd be like certain foods or taking poison. You know, you can the poison has chemical vibratory levels that could actually be really very harmful to the cells. And at the same time, that everybody can process the vibration differently, that if you take a certain level of a negative substance and you expose it to 10 different people, well, they'll get 10 different levels of response to it. They won't all have the same response. And, you know, I've seen it over the years where you could put somebody in a very polluted environment, you know, energetically, where it's not only music, but it's polluted by toxins in the air. And some people, cellularly, they'll get malformation and cancer, while others will not be affected by it and actually can thrive in it. So it's very fascinating. And the thing that the key is that largely it's about how we respond, learning to respond to these things. So the preference does make a difference. Like hearing something that is really that you don't like. It could be like, for instance, you can have a beautiful piece of music, like a Mozart piece, and whatever, and you might dislike it so much that you're actually energetically harmed by it.
Bringing that back to yoga, when you do the poses, when students of Anusara Yoga go through the poses, there is probably for some students at times experience of joy and ecstasy, but probably at other times there's the experience of pain and suffering and cramps and all sorts of things that they experience in their bodies. How does that analogize to the rest of their lives? How do you work with the negative stuff that comes up in yoga?
Yeah, again, really good, because in general, there's always going to be some sort of discomfort associated with transformation, and on a physical level, emotional level, et cetera, and the psychological responses. In large part, it is about how we react to these things. So you learn that, you know, at first you have a beginner and they just do a standing forward bend and the back of their legs hurt so much because they're stiff that they'll tend to have aversion to even just doing that. And a lot of people will even quit yoga very quickly because there is so much discomfort. And but as you stay practicing the yoga with these different types of uncomfortable sensations, you learn how to respond in ways that are more equanimous, that you're not reacting so much. You're not trying to fight with the sensations, nor are you running away from them. So you know that you learn through your experience that a lot of these sensations are actually associated with healing and with positive transformation. So you actually welcome them more, and that you're able to hang in there while you're, you know, getting a strong sensation in the class. And then taking that, you're able to take it from your mat and you take it right into your life. And instead of reacting so much to someone's words toward you or toward the things you're observing around you, you're able to be cooler, and then you make choices about what is going to really be enhancing, how you're going to speak, how you're going to act in ways that will be life enhancing. So you will really learn through the yoga practice how to respond in the highest, even off your mat, outside the classroom.
Well, John Friend, I want to thank you for spending this time with us here on KSFR.
Thanks so much for having me. And I look forward to being there in Santa Fe this weekend.
Well, we look forward to having you here.
Thanks so much.
We've been talking to John Friend, the founder of Anusara Yoga. He will be in Santa Fe tomorrow, Friday, October 5th, giving a Dharma talk called Transforming the Profane into the Sacred with special guest classical Indian musician Jyoti Chalam. That's this Friday from 7 to 8 at the Immaculate Heart of Mary Retreat Center at 50 Mount Carmel Road. For more information, go to anusara.com. And we've been listening to John Friend, who will be tomorrow night, October 5th, from 7 to 8 at the Immaculate Heart of Mary Retreat Center at 50 Mount Carmel Road in Santa Fe. He's the founder of Anusara Yoga, and his Dharma talk will be called Transforming the Profane into the Sacred. You're listening to KSFR, Santa Fe Radio Cafe, broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. I'd like now to welcome Tony Lagaranis. He is a former Army interrogator in Abu Ghraib. He's the author of the new book, Fear Up Harsh, An Army Interrogator's Dark Journey Through Iraq. And he will be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Forum at the College of Santa Fe in a talk entitled Lessons from Abu Ghraib. It's part of the College of Santa Fe's Beyond the Lecture Series. Welcome.
Thank you.
You went to St. John's College here in Santa Fe. You ended up in the Army, in Army Interrogator School. What did you learn there, and how did that compare to what was actually practiced in Iraq?
Our interrogation school was at Fort Huachuca, Arizona, and I think it was about 9 weeks long. And we did role-playing with our instructors. They would play a detainee, either a conventional soldier with a conventional army or an insurgent. And we would have to develop a line of questioning to elicit what he knew. And I should mention that when we were training with the insurgency, it was an insurgency that had organized itself as an army. with a very definite structure. That was very different than what we encountered in Iraq. And we also learned to treat the detainees strictly according to Geneva Conventions, which is very clear that you cannot, there cannot be any negative repercussions for a detainee who is not cooperating with you, who refuses to answer your questions. You can never threaten a detainee. You can certainly never cause him physical harm. You can't deny him any medical attention. And then when we got to Iraq, that sort of went out the window.
So when you got to Iraq, you were basically told that those rules didn't apply?
That's right. And the first indication we had of that was a memo issued by the Pentagon, which it was called the Interrogation Rules of Engagement in IRO. And it laid down what we could and couldn't do. And among these things was the use of military working dogs on a detainee, environmental manipulation, which, if that sounds vague to you, it's because it is vague. We took that to mean that we could put them in an extremely hot room or a very cold room, douse them with ice water to induce hypothermia. We also used stress positions. That was listed very clearly on the interrogation rules of engagement. So these things were clearly not in accordance with Geneva. And so we asked our superiors about it, and we said, why would we be allowed to do these things? And they said, because Geneva Conventions don't apply to these detainees.
And how did the other interrogators feel about it? Did they feel the same way you did?
Well, it's hard for me to even remember how I felt about it. I mean, I was certainly concerned, but I think I was concerned about the legality of it. I felt confident that if we did use these techniques, it would be in a controlled fashion. And I should mention, too, that most of the techniques that I just described, the harsh tactics I just described, we weren't using those at Abu Ghraib. It wasn't until I went to Mosul that I started seeing these tactics employed.
We're talking to Tony Lagaranis. So, these techniques, some of them that you practiced, some of them that you saw, some of them you'd seen things that were done to prisoners who were in really bad shape. You wrote some abuse reports. These reports disappeared.
Yes, I don't know what happened to them, but I filed multiple reports while I was in Iraq, and I also filed a report with criminal investigations of the Army when I returned to my base in Georgia after my tour in Iraq. And then when I was discharged from the Army, I went to Frontline and appeared on Frontline and talking about some of these abuses. And immediately afterwards, criminal investigations contacted me, and they said that they ran my name through their computer, and they found no reports for me and asked me why I had not filed any sworn statements with them.
But in fact, you had.
In fact, I had filed multiple.
So another thing that you have spoken about and written about is that there was really an element of sadism that you saw in this that went far above and beyond the intelligence gathering phenomenon. And military police were involved in this, many of whom were prison guards in civilian life.
That's right. And I mean, I hesitate to call it sadism. I know I've used that word before, but in light of reading Dr. Zimbardo's study at the Stanford Prison Experiment, he demonstrates that ordinary people, when put in a power situation like a prison, they tend to behave very badly, and abuse becomes very common. So it's not necessarily an aberration of human behavior. It's certainly a dark part of human behavior. So it's true. People were excited when they came in the proximity of an interrogation. They wanted to participate, and they wanted to participate using abuse. I even saw that with we interrogators. We sometimes would abuse people who we didn't even suspect that they had intelligence. We simply wanted a confession out of them, or even if we didn't want a confession, we were simply frustrated and angry, and would employ these harsh tactics on people that for no purpose.
Your job was to get intelligence about the insurgency, but as you write, there wasn't even a coherent infrastructure to make sense of the intelligence.
That's right. There's a belief in the intelligence community that the people doing human intelligence collection are getting tiny pieces of information, and they probably won't be able to synthesize it, but it goes up to the next level, and it will get analyzed by military analysts. In my experience, that never happened. The analysis was they were completely incompetent. And part of that was because they had people doing the analysis who had no idea of the structure and the culture that they were dealing with in Iraq. They didn't understand the language. They didn't understand the people. One intelligence analyst asked me at one point what the Ba'ath Party was. He had no idea what the Ba'ath Party was.
Oh, my goodness.
Another intelligence analyst asked me just before the 2004 election whether George Bush was a Democrat or a Republican. These are the people that are in charge of synthesizing the intelligence that we're producing.
And on top of that, there were supposed to be databases and software that connected them all, but that didn't work either.
Right. That was extremely frustrating. The Army had developed hardware and software for the entire intelligence community to use while deployed. And we brought all that stuff with us, and we were all trained on that. And all that equipment and all that software sat in our shipping containers all year long, and we were using desktop computers with completely different software. And each unit had different software, so we couldn't communicate. We couldn't communicate between different prisons. So if I had, for instance, a detainee, I knew his brother was in another detention facility. I couldn't communicate with the interrogators at the other detention facilities to feed them questions or to request information from him.
So this quest to get the big picture from lots of little pieces just simply didn't happen at all in your experience.
In my experience, no. It wasn't working.
We're talking to Tony Lagaranis. He is speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Forum at the College of Santa Fe in a talk titled Lessons from Abu Ghraib. In an interview, you're quoted as saying that when the Abu Ghraib scandal broke, it quote, gave us power to refuse to do any harsh tactics. But at that base, you said, I saw the most egregious abuse. They stopped torturing people in prisons and would torture them before they got to prison. Tell us about that.
You're referring to when I was in North Babel, which is south of Baghdad, at a base called FOB Kelsey. And we were working with the Marines out there, and particularly the Force Recon Marines. They would go on a raid, and they would stay in the detainees' home and interrogate and torture them in their homes. So we were getting detainees from this unit that had broken bones, smashed feet, sometimes third-degree burns. There was nothing subtle about what they were doing at all. It was really brutal.
Do you feel that anybody has been held accountable for what happened there?
Well, I mean, you know of the so-called bad apples at Abu Ghraib, but I think that the military doesn't want to pursue prosecutions of people who've committed crimes elsewhere because it would demonstrate that abuse was actually systemic and it was happening all over the place. The military would rather have the perception that abuse only occurred at one particular time in one particular place.
What's your perception of that?
Well, in my experience, it was systemic. And the reason it was systemic is because these harsh interrogation tactics were explicitly and in some cases tacitly allowed all the way through our chain of command, all the way up to the Pentagon.
We're talking to Tony Lagaranis. So the value of the intelligence gathering that you participated in was basically zero. The Iraqi resistance continues, the insurgency, and, you know, if the picture you paint is a picture of what's still going on there, U.S. intelligence gathering is essentially worthless. What do you think would be a better way of going about dealing with the conflict there? What do you think would be most effective?
Well, human intelligence collection, of which interrogation is a part, is an extremely important tool in fighting an insurgency. So we really need to fix that system. Part of the problem is that most of the interrogators that you have in the interrogation room in Iraq right now are young kids. This is their first deployment. They know very little about the people that they're dealing with. And instead, what we need to do is build a core of people who are experienced, know what they're doing, and are good at their jobs. They need to be selected according to their ability. And we don't seem to be interested in doing that. For instance, if I had returned to Iraq, I would have been promoted by that time. Instead of going to the interrogation booth, I would be a leader and administrator. I would be shuffling emails rather than actually interrogating. That's the wrong way to do it.
You learned Arabic.
Correct.
So did you feel that there was any, in your training, any cultural component to it that actually helped you understand the people that you were supposed to be understanding?
Well, I think to some measure, but that really wasn't a large part of our curriculum. They did have a small unit on cultural understanding, but it wasn't very well put together. And I should mention also that all of my teachers were Coptic Christians. Copts are from Egypt. They're Christians from Egypt. And they had real contempt for Arabs and particularly Muslims. So they weren't very interested in teaching us anything about the Middle Eastern culture except for their own.
And those are the people who were teaching you Arabic?
Those are the people teaching you Arabic, yes, and the ones who taught us the cultural part. And then when we got to Iraq, at Abu Ghraib, we received a briefing from an army psychiatrist, and he was supposed to give us some cultural training. And what he drew from was mainly a book by Raphael Patai called The Arab Mind. And I haven't read that book myself, but from what I gleaned from his briefing, it's the worst book you could possibly use. Part of his briefing was that Arabs, they can't think rationally. They think associatively. They don't think linearly. They have a different relation to truth than we do, which, you know, it means that they're born liars. That's basically what he meant. They can't create a timeline. They can't think, as I said, they can't think linearly, so that, you know, they can't think of things in a regular time progression as we would. Things, I mean, this was pure racism, what he was telling us.
You went to Fallujah, and when you were there, I mean, you saw the bloodbath. You had to deal with a lot of bodies, including identifying the corpses. And one of your jobs was to determine how many of them were foreigners as opposed to local people from Fallujah. And I guess there was a great incentive for you to identify people as foreigners. Is that correct?
Well, there wasn't, you know, a tangible incentive, but we understood that that's what our leaders wanted to find. So some of the people I was working with would take anything that they could construe to make this guy a foreigner, and they would mark him down as a foreigner. For instance, if he had a Quran on him and it was printed in Algeria, they would say, this guy's an Algerian. Or we had a couple guys come in with... I don't remember what, the khaki pants and a black shirt or something like that. And he said, well, that's clearly the Hezbollah uniform, so these guys must be from Lebanon. I mean, it was just ridiculous what these people were doing to cook the books.
And it was all for political reasons.
That's why they wanted to show that we had a lot of foreigners there. It was for political reasons, because at that time they were still trying to say that Iraqis really love us. It's foreign agitators that are creating this insurgency.
So how did you finally get out of Iraq? What was the situation that led you back home and to your honorable discharge?
Well, our tour was up, so my entire unit left Iraq. We returned to our base at Fort Gordon, Georgia. And when I returned, I started having some psychological problems, and certainly I had big issues with the Army. I was very angry at my leaders for putting us in a position to violate Geneva Conventions and ordering us to violate Geneva Conventions. And I felt that our entire mission was a failure. So that ultimately led to a medical discharge, which gave me an honorable discharge in July of 2005.
And what made you decide to come out and really make this all this information that you're telling us public?
Well, as I said, I had reported abuses to criminal investigations, and I'd also reported up my chain of command, including the chain of command of the Marine unit I was working with. And it seemed that the military was not interested in fixing itself at all. In fact, they didn't even want to hear about abuse. So I went to the media, and I started talking about it in the media.
And you went to a lot of the mainstream media and Democracy Now and so on.
Correct. Yeah, the second interview I did was with Frontline, and once that aired, a lot of media outlets were interested in speaking with me.
So what has that process been like for you?
Well, it's helped me. I mean, you know, especially when I go on a show with listeners that call in. I mean, I get asked some challenging questions, and so it's helped me to think about my experience and you know how how I reflect on it. I mean, if I hadn't been challenged that way, maybe I wouldn't have as good of an understanding.
I mean, you, before we went on the air, you were talking about how there are people from the left who give you a hard time for having done what you were involved with in Iraq, and then people who are from the military who give you a hard time for having talked about it.
That's right. Yeah, both the right and the left find reasons to attack me, but you know, so I never know what to expect when I go and I speak at a forum, but we'll see what happens tonight at the College of Santa Fe.
Tony Lagaranis will be tonight at the forum at the College of Santa Fe. His book is called Fear Up Harsh, An Army Interrogator's Dark Journey Through Iraq. Now, this book has been out for several months. You've been on the road talking about it. Does it get to a point where you're done talking about it?
Yeah, I think I might be past that point. At this point, I'm just sort of fulfilling commitments to speak. I think it. At first, it was good for me to relate this experience and get this word out. But you know, at some point, I sort of want to move on.
What would you like to do next?
I'm hoping to get a job with a human rights organization, and I've developed relationships with several of them, and I think I won't have a problem getting a job.
When you meet young people who are considering going into the Army, what do you tell them, or what would you tell them if they asked you?
Well, I would have to know, you know, why they were joining the military. I don't know, but I certainly would tell them, you know, that they really need to stick to their guns before they follow orders. They need to figure out the legality of it, and if they're unsure of the legality of it, as we weren't sure if what we were performing was legal or not. I would say don't perform the order until you talk to a lawyer.
Would that have been an option for you, looking back in retrospect?
I guess so. I mean, we were being given direct orders to employ these techniques, and we thought that they were legal. We certainly had some doubt. So, but we thought that if we refused that order, then a court-martial would ensue. But in looking back, I think that they probably wouldn't have pursued that. I think they would have been afraid to do that.
Because the word would have gotten out.
Maybe the word would have gotten out, but I think that they probably, my direct leaders probably were unsure of the legality of it also, and they wouldn't want to expose themselves to that kind of danger.
Well, Tony Lagaranis, I want to thank you very much for being with us here at the Santa Fe Baking Company. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Tony Lagaranis is former Army interrogator and Abu Ghraib. He's the author of the new book, Fear Up Harsh, An Army Interrogator's Dark Journey Through Iraq. And he will be speaking tonight at the forum at the College of Santa Fe at 7 o'clock in a talk titled Lessons from Abu Ghraib. It's part of the College of Santa Fe's Beyond the Lecture series. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can hear this show and any show at you can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org, and you can hear the show at santafe.radiocafe.org. And let's see, that's thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laura Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Good Morning Jazz. We want to thank everybody who contributed during our fundraiser. If you didn't contribute, you can still go online at ksfr.org and make a pledge that way. In any case, we reached our goal in just a little over a week, and we thank you so much. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow, Robert Knott will be here speaking of the arts and much, much more. Keep your dial tuned to 101.1 FM and 90.7 FM. KSFR, Santa Fe Public Radio. Hasta la vista.